You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Henry Martin.
Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro, is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Who wants to love a billionaire? Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Do you have a favorite writer whose books are auto-buys for you? Wouldn't you love for readers to have you on their auto-buy list? Then recommend your books to their friends and on social media? The good news is there are subtle things you can do, things that are nearly invisible to the reader, that will make your stories unputdownable. The Beyond 10 Days course from Victory Editing can help you get the most from your stories and help you build that relationship with readers through your writing. This course is full of awesome, and best of all, you don't have to fly across the country or put on pants. In this course, we'll focus on avoiding info dumps, dialogue mechanics, show versus tell in dialogue, carrying show versus tell forward to your narrative, deepening your point of view and strengthening your protagonist's voice, overwriting and how to avoid it, 10 hours of video content with text and audio downloads. Shine that diamond. Join me at the Beyond 10 Days course. Go to HankGarner.com and click the banner to sign up today. Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. The Feisty Heroine Romance Collection of Short Stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award-winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution.
Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode.
Thanks for joining me for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Kimmeri Martin back on the show with me. She was with us last year, about a year and a half ago, when we talked about her new book, The Queen of Hearts, and what an amazing book that was. Well, she is here today to talk about her brand new book. It's called The Antidote for Everything, and I think you guys are really going to love it. Welcome back to the show, Kimmeri.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. The new book is out. What was different for you about writing this follow-up after having a book that was out that people loved and really embraced? Was writing this book very different for you from the debut book, The Queen of Hearts?
Yes. I would say it was much more difficult to write the second book. And I think I'm not alone in that. I hear a lot of authors say that. you know, it's kind of like the first time around, I was unburdened by much knowledge of the publishing industry or writing technique, which was kind of oddly freeing.
Yes.
Yeah. So the second time, there were a lot more, you know, expectations and timelines.
Well, you know, we talk about the gift of anonymity, that when you're writing that first book, no one knows you're doing it. Maybe, you know, you've told a couple of friends or, you know, some family members or a spouse or something like that. But, you know, no one's expecting it. There are no people to answer to for it. And that sophomore effort is there comes, you know, especially when you've had success with the first book, that comes with expectations, which you know, are a good motivator for sure. But did you doubt that you could follow up with, you know, with a tale that gripped people as much as the first one?
Well, the first time's a real labor of love. You're doing it because you enjoy it, not because anyone is paying you to do it. The second time, yeah, there's more pressure, but as a trade-off, you also have a better understanding of storytelling, I think, or at least in my case, I had a better understanding of what I was supposed to be doing. I still love writing. So the process to me is infinitely absorbing. I won't say I was certain I could produce a good story, but I was certain that I would, you know, do my damnedest to try.
You have really found a niche and really sort of formed your own niche here, and you know, with the stories that you tell, which are you know, based around the medical industry and the people that work in there, and they're reminiscent of Grey's Anatomy with various elements in there. What do you think it is about these kinds of stories and these characters that people resonate with so strongly?
Well, it is very niche-y because there isn't a lot of pure medical fiction out there. And what there is tends to be either thrillers or romances. So sort of contemporary medical fiction is a little bit more unusual. But I think it is relatable because everyone understands medical care. You know, I'm not trying to tell the story of a venture capitalist or, you know, a bond trader or something arcane that's hard to understand. We all know what it's like to go to the doctor. We all know what it's like to be sick. So that lends the story some inherent relatability.
Well, not only relatability, but there's something extremely human about these kinds of stories. We're literally talking about the most personal aspects of life and relationships. Do you think that kind of getting straight down to the quick of things helps to build stories that we can all relate to more quickly than, like you said, you know, if you're writing about a venture capitalist, we still have to find the humanity in this. This kind of comes with that built in. Do you think that makes it relatable for a wide audience, even if they don't think that this would be a story for them?
Sure, because everyone is interested in mortality. You know, there is a certain amount of built-in drama to the medical profession. You're assessing life from the first breath to the last breath and all the drama that occurs in between. And so, yes, I think that is just interesting in and of itself to people.
We see in the news a lot, especially it's an election year here in the United States, and, you know, medical care and the medical system and how we pay for that and how, you know, it is ingrained in our life and in our society is a campaign platform for a lot of people. Do you feel like that those issues come into your writing, and how do you feel like that the way that we integrate healthcare into our society plays a part in the books that you write?
Oh, wow. That's a huge topic. I have strong opinions about it. I think our present system of healthcare is not only ineffective, but immoral. As an emergency medicine physician, I've certainly seen my share of people who work hard their whole lives and go bankrupt because they can't afford healthcare. And to me, that is just completely unacceptable. That's the easy answer. I mean, obviously, it's so difficult to approach this when we have such a firmly entrenched system of healthcare in place, and many people have built-in advocacy based on what, you know, how healthcare affects them. And by that, I mean, you know, not just doctors, but also insurance companies and administrators and politicians and suppliers. And, you know, there's just a whole huge chain of people that impact healthcare. So I don't think I could give a qualified answer to what the solution is, but I know that what we have is not acceptable.
Right. And you know, those big topics like that are rife with all sorts of discussion, as they should be. But, you know, to make a story that engages people and that draws us in and makes us care about the things that are going on, we need characters that we care about. And those characters that you introduce us to are, we've got really two prime characters, Georgia Brown and Jonah. Tell us about them and where they came from for you.
So Georgia is the main protagonist. She's a urologist, and she was a minor character in The Queen of Hearts. She was a medical school friend of the main characters of that book. And she has a lot of verve, you know, a very vivid personality, and seemed like she would be a fun character to spin off. So that's what I did. I decided to spin off a book for her. And I had this one sentence in The Queen of Hearts that said she grew up to become a urologist in Charleston. So that gave me a medical specialty and a location. And then I'm interested in friendship as a fundamental human relationship, because our friends are the people we pick. You know, you don't have familial ties or sexual entanglement or romance with your friends. And in fact, between Georgia and Jonah, there's no possibility of romantic involvement between them, because Georgia is straight and Jonah is gay. So the book is an exploration mainly of their friendship and the thing that goes spectacularly wrong between them.
When you started thinking about these characters and thinking of Georgia as a perfect character to spin off, and then, you know, Jonah as the perfect friend for her to explore this, how did you start, you know, finding a story for them? Do you start thinking about just dropping these characters into the world that you built? Are you then interested in other topics that you can explore with these characters? Kind of, how do you start finding where the story is going to be?
Well, for me, it's kind of a hellish process. I'm not a plotter. So I wish I could, you know, plot out a novel ahead of time. And I'm actually trying to do that with my third book, which has got a very interesting topic. But for the first two, I just sort of sat down and spewed out nonsense until it consolidated into something more coherent. And with Georgia and Jonah, I started with a completely different plot than the one we ultimately settled on, which is this issue of medical discrimination. At first, I had one of them dying of a brain tumor, and I was going in all kinds of directions, and then I finally focused on this.
So, and you make a note of that in the book, that that this the story went in a different direction for you. When you were working on that brain tumor storyline, what made you decide to abandon that and pick up the storyline that, that you did follow through with?
My editor. She thought it would be too grim to have she's like, you know, that sounds a little depressing, Kimmery, if we kill off the main character with a brain tumor. And I said, oh, but I think it would be great. I could do it. And yeah, no. So I came to this topic circuitously, but there were a couple things that inspired it. I live in North Carolina, and we had a law or regulation passed that was prohibiting communities from passing their own anti-discrimination laws. So my city had passed an anti-discrimination bill of some sort, and then the state stepped in and said, you can't do that. And it got me curious about what the people who make our laws think is an acceptable reason to fire someone. You know, what should be legal when it comes to a reason to, for firing someone from a job or for refusing them housing or medical care, as is, you know, germane to the book. So that was one thing that kind of piqued my curiosity. And then the other big inspiration for this novel was more personal. I had a colleague who was instructed not to treat transgender patients. And when they refused to comply with that, they were fired.
What? Not treat them at all?
Not treat them at all. Yeah. In that practice. It was a privately owned practice, I believe.
Wow. That's intense.
Yeah. Yeah. And eye-opening, yeah. Right? Because I think a lot of people are genuinely shocked to learn that right now in the United States, in many states, it is not illegal to fire someone simply because they're gay or because they're transgender. And in certain circumstances, it's not illegal to refuse medical care on either of those bases. So that is genuinely surprising to a lot of people and somewhat in flux. I mean, the laws are changing. And right now, the Supreme Court's already heard a case about employment discrimination. So that may change or may not change. I don't know.
Wow. Well, that is perfect fodder to drop in some tension into a story. So, you know, we can't just let a good plot device like that go to waste. Tell me how you integrated that into Georgia and Georgia's story.
Yeah, so the plot is sort of the framework for me. And the main thrust of my writing, I think, comes from characterization. So I really dove into what Georgia was like and what Jonah was like, and then came up with this tension between them after Jonah gets fired. And he's fired for a very similar reason to my real life colleague, which is he's instructed not to treat transgender patients any longer, and they constitute a lot of his practice. So he refuses this ultimatum, and then he loses his job. And Georgia, of course, wants nothing more than to help her closest friend in the world, but she actually manages to make things a lot worse in the way that she responds. Yeah.
Well, and you've got this great tension here because you've got the friendship and Georgia wanting to stand with Jonah, her friend, and make some sort of moral stand there. But she also is a physician who must decide if making her moral stand is more important than staying in the system and you know, doing the good work daily that she does. Talk a little bit about those tensions, and is that something that doctors, since you can speak to this, you know, are faced with daily? That do we take a stand and make some noise, or are we better suited to stay where we are and maybe bring about change from the inside wherever we can?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me personally, I never had any kind of institutional dictates that didn't allow me to practice good medicine in terms of, you know, who I could treat. But there's always things that you want to do for your patients that you can't do. That's a daily tension, I think, for a lot of doctors. One of the biggest examples probably is time. You know, we're very driven to see people expeditiously, and we're graded on that and sometimes paid on that. And that makes it hard to do the job that you would really like to do for each patient, or at least for me, it did. And then there, you know, medicine is becoming increasingly corporatized, I guess might be the word. You know, a lot of medical practices and clinics and hospitals are run by business people now, and their goals are not necessarily the goals of the clinicians. You know, they're driven by profit. So yeah, a lot of doctors are very frustrated with that.
When you're dealing with moral issues like this, there's a changing landscape of the way people feel about you know, things that 20 or 30 years ago would have that never been talked about. When you're dealing with issues like that, are you conscious of how the reader is going to receive this and what the kind of changing accepted morals are of the day?
Yes and no. I mean, I have kind of a irreverent writing style to begin with. Like, I can get a little bit on the snarky side, and so I'm going to piss people off no matter what I do. or I'm going to make people love, you know, like everyone's response is subjective. In terms of changing morals, though, you can't really write to try to please a majority or to please a crowd. I mean, I think you have to remain true to whatever the story is. And if you're trying to write to not offend people, or if you're trying to write to placate people, that you're just, I don't think that would be authentic.
Right, right. What are some of the things, well, first off, how did you prepare for a book like this? You're writing a straight female character, and then you're writing a gay male, and then with transgender people. How did you prepare yourself to portray these characters as authentically as you did?
Well, I did give that a lot of thought. I would have really liked to have written from Jonah's perspective, but I didn't. I felt like the more authentic presentation for me would be to write a novel from the point of view of an LGBTQ ally, not someone in that community themselves, because that really isn't my story to tell. But the story is so crouched in this medical framework. I do think it's important that doctors not sit back and passively allow other people to fight battles when they pertain to medicine. So I kind of thought it was legitimate to have an ally story. I can see that maybe people might disagree with that, and that's okay. I did have a lot of sensitivity readers. I think I had 6. So I did go to people in the LGBTQ community and say, hey, will you read this for me and tell me what you think? And that actually wound up being one of the greatest blessings of my whole life, because one of my sensitivity readers subsequently became an incredibly close friend. And so I got this huge blessing out of having done that, that had nothing to do with the book.
Wow. Wow. When all of this happens in the book, and you've got Georgia, who, as you alluded to earlier, makes things much worse, how do you start looking for things to up the ante? You know, because you've got this reveal pretty early in the book where you know Jonah gets fired, and then Georgia is brought to, you know, to this decision point. How do you keep upping the ante and finding new trouble for them to get into?
Oh, I'm fine at creating trouble. I don't know. That's not a struggle. Georgia does compromise her integrity in the book. And she does it for a good reason. She wants to help her friend. But it also sort of brings up this secondary issue, which is that we are living in a time where perspective and spin almost seem to matter more than facts do. And Georgia taps into some of that. You know, her approach to the problem is to try to manipulate perception. And she doesn't always do it in an ethical way. So it's a little bit of a microcosm of, you know, what we're seeing so much now, which is that opinion seems to dominate our public discourse more than anything objective does.
As a doctor yourself, how fun is it to write these situations and kind of play out, you know, these dark fantasies of things that you would never do in real life, or maybe you would? Is it fun to explore, you know, an alternate reality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. First of all, I love delving into other medical specialties, and I have a huge community of people that help me crowdsource doing that. So I have really enjoyed it. Then another answer to your question is not really related to me being a doctor, but I do have a lot of fun creating villains and kind of giving them a comeuppance. So I have had lots of fun punishing the bad guys.
Oh, that's so funny. Being your second book, your follow-up book, did you begin this book differently than you did the first book? You know, when you're sitting down and, okay, I'm gonna start this thing. Was the beginning of the creative process different this time than it was the last time?
Yeah, as a novice author, I was kind of worried about sounding redundant. And I decided to write this book in the third person because I was a little bit afraid that the voice would be too similar to the main characters of my first book if I didn't. And I think I've kind of grown past that now, but I do have a distinctive voice myself as an author, and I wanted to differentiate between the two stories as much as I could. So I decided in the beginning I would write in third person, and I think it worked out pretty well for Georgia that way.
Well, writing in third person, did you find, and even though you said you feel like that you've grown past that trepidation of having your first person character sound too much alike, did writing in the third person give you more tools to use or allow you to narrate the book differently, give more information maybe? How do you feel like writing in third person, you know, what was a benefit to writing in first person?
Well, I will say I don't have a preference between the two. I'm very comfortable writing in both first and third. The Antidote for Everything was written in very close third person, or limited third person. So there's not an omniscient narrator that can see everything. And it's really still told through Georgia's eyes, but in the third person. So it gave me a little bit more tools to use, but not as much as it would have if I had gone to a more omniscient point of view.
How was your writing process different for this book than the first one? Other than you've got a deadline, and it can't just be open ended. Did you plan differently? Did you have a plan for you know, a schedule and things like that when this book came along?
I was just writing in crisis mode the whole time because I was so far behind. For me, that's the hardest thing about being an author is I would like to endlessly tinker with the book. And I think I could have made it a lot better if I'd had more time. And I may feel that about all books, but yeah, it kind of pained me to turn it in because I felt like I could have expanded it more.
How far were you into the manuscript with that first storyline, the brain tumor storyline, before you scrapped that and started over with the new storyline?
Well, that wasn't even the first book I proposed. I had already gotten halfway through, or maybe more than halfway through, a completely different novel when I finished The Queen of Hearts. And I love that novel, and the publisher didn't. They didn't actually even want to read it because it was a little bit of a different genre. It was very sciencey and had a male protagonist, and they just didn't want that from me. They said my audience might not like such an abrupt shift, and I countered with, I don't have an audience. So, you know, but I hope to write that book as maybe my fourth book. It actually states in my contract now with Penguin Random House that my books have to have a female physician as the protagonist.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is very niche-y.
Yeah. Well, niche-y or brand, however you want to, you know, look at that. Have you, you know, having the first book out and it really finding an audience, and the second book's been out for about a week now. Are you getting feedback from readers, and what kind of feedback are they telling you?
Well, the readers that reach out to me are giving me great feedback. You know, they're probably a lot less likely to reach out if they hate the book. But yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised.
You'd be surprised.
Well, no, yeah, you're right. I have in fact heard from people who hated the first book, but it has been nice. I mean, sometimes you strike a chord with people, and when that happens, it's very rewarding. It's very gratifying. I mean, there's probably not a better feeling in the universe than knowing that someone really loved your writing.
Right, right. Well, the new book, The Antidote for Everything, which is out available everywhere now. Kimmery, when people finish this book, what do you hope they're left with?
Well, I do hope that they get some entertainment out of the book and also kind of enjoy a fly-on-the-wall glimpse of the medical industry. But I also hope that it spurs some thought about, you know, discrimination and the way that we treat each other and what we see as human rights.
Right, right. The Antidote for Everything is available everywhere now. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode. Kimmery, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show. We're going to send everyone to pick up their copy. If people are just learning about you, where can they find you online to connect with you?
Well, I have a book review website, KimmeryMartin.com, and I'm on Instagram at KimmeryMartin and Twitter and Facebook.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you, and thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The Near Future. Humanity's only hope of survival entered the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class,
he thought. Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call. When did I get this app? He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked.
You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa.
Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller. "You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire?" the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?"
he asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.